what connects the talks this weekend together? Because it sounds, it may sound like a little bit like they're popcorn, random here and there, but I actually have, if you looked at the resume that Dick just brought up, my history has been in focusing on education and family issues. And I know that's something that a lot of normal human beings care about, but it's not something that actually typically tends to get a lot of attention and play in politics. It doesn't get a lot of attention and play among a lot of the conservative publications on the right. You know, education is kind of relegated to a corner. And I think part of that is legitimate because a lot of these big publications, you know, focus on national issues and the federal government doesn't have a constitutional right to be involved in education. So there's a reason for that. But I deeply care about education, honestly. First of all, because I have children and you see exactly how much that affects them. And so I started there. I've done also, you know, some teaching history in my life. So I love to be with kids in the classroom. But I've also had a lot of background in education. So so it's just been a really big, important passion of mine. And it is something that we get a lot of attention on at the Federalist. A lot of people want to read those articles, even though a lot of lawmakers, I don't think, do a really good job of legislating about education. They tend to buy kind of the talking points that come from big business, from corporations, from all these people at what World Magazine editor Marvin Lassie calls the C-suite level, government, think tanks, nonprofit organizations, what they call stakeholders, but very, very little is said about what actually happens in the classroom, children, parents, families at the ground level, the people who are there every day. And that has become one of my number one focuses, especially after going through the Common Core meat grinder that we'll talk about tomorrow. So, but I also, I truly believe that a family is the building block of society. And if you look at society and think it's a big, giant mess, then we should be focusing on the families and our individual selves. And we can't have a self-governing country like our founders intended if we don't have self-governing individuals, and that requires self-governing families. So if you look out at the public and you don't like what you see, change starts at home. And I mean, being in the conservative sort of sphere, I'm used to people throwing stuff at the TV and complaining and shouting and then never really getting up off the couch and doing anything to change it, and that drives me crazy. So that actually is really the reason that I focus on these home habits of self-government, of self-control, of self-behavior, because I do believe that our country is only as good as we are because of the unique kind of country that we have. So if all of us want a better country, we have to start with being better people and managing our families better and being better friends, being better cousins, sisters, aunts, uncles. And that is one of the reasons that I care so much about the screen addictions that we all have. So the first thing that I wanted to do when talking about this is to just basically hit you over the head with a bunch of data because I don't think a lot of people are really aware of the actual, there's been a lot of scientific research that's been done on this topic that a lot of people are not aware of. And I think actually if you all just saw the brain scan picture talking about people who are addicts to porn, there are very similar images for people who are addicts to the internet. And so some of the pornography addiction effects on the brain are related to the compulsive behavior, the clicking, the going back for more, the sitting. You know, so the online pornography has changed pornography by accelerating it, and that's really what technology does to all of us with all kinds of thinking. Obviously, you know, if you're looking at pictures of cute dogs, that's not inherently evil like pornography is, but the way that it trains your brain to think, the compulsive and addictive and kind of wormhole behavior that it leads into, those are commonalities between those two things. And they do have similar deteriorating effects on the brain. I don't believe that people automatically do the right thing when they know what it is, but I think they're more likely to. So let's just start with a little bit of information about what that is. But the first thing that I wanted to do is, how many of you have ever read the book 1984, kind of aware of its general? Okay, that's pretty good. Everyone else who hasn't, read it. Maybe there's a couple of young people in the front here. There's some scenes that I recommend. Maybe read it if you're 16 or older. how about, have any of you read Brave New World? Okay, wow, that's a pretty good, oh great. So I'll give you a quick sketch of what the two, so 1984 is a picture kind of a Soviet Union totalitarianism. It's dark, it's cold, a lot of people get dragged down, you know, beaten up and shot by their evil overweening government. It's very repressive and dark, you know, so if you're familiar with the Soviet Union, that's kind of the world of 1984. Brave New World is a different kind of dictatorship in which people basically make themselves slaves by becoming weak. they become addicted to this, the managerial government uses a substance called soma, but it's basically like a pleasure pill, pornography, you know, there are all kinds of things that are pleasure pills, and I think actually entertainment addictions are one of them. Netflix, pleasure pill. So rather than, you know, controlling people through fear and terror and intimidation, the government of Brave New World controls people through their appetites. There's been a lot of debates about what kind of government ours is tending towards, and it seems to be that our society, or actually probably much more familiar to you, is WALL-E, right? Our society is kind of the WALL-E society, the Brave New World society, where we're losing our rights because we haven't become the kind of people that stand up to protect them. And part of that is because we're distracted and we're watching screens all the time. So with that, let's get into a little bit of the data portion. And then after we talk about kind of some of the research about that, then I want to talk about what this kind of means and tie it in together to talk about, yet to kind of explore bigger consequences for what the data means. So one of my favorite and scariest statistics is from, there's an organization called Common Sense Media that does a lot of big media surveys. And so one of the things that they found is that children who were ages 2 to 8 averaged 2.5 to 3 hours every day of screen time, which equals about 20 hours per week. That's kids age 2 to 8. Those are my kids and younger. Kids who are ages 8 to 12 average 4.5 hours of daily screen time, or more than 30 hours per week. Teens average more than 6 hours per day, or more than 40 hours per week. And these are big, giant population samples. These aren't just like a couple of kids. You know, this is a real average, national average, giant, amount of kid tracking. And by the way, none of this is for school, because school-age kids average 16 minutes a day of school-related screen time. So 16 minutes, you know, so if we're talking about teens spending more than 6 hours a day, that 6 hours of that is, you know, Snapchat, Facebook, whatever, you know, just hanging out, goofing off, Netflix, whatever. One of the things that I pointed out in the article I wrote is that this is the equivalent of, for the younger kids, a part-time job spent watching television, and for the bigger kids, it's the equivalent of a full-time job spent watching, or not watching, I mean, part of that's watching television, but consuming screen entertainment. So the question is, what mental and physical and moral habits does this level of screen addiction cultivate in ourselves and in our children? And by the way, adults, you aren't exempt either. if all of you are aware of the sociologist Robert Putnam in his book Bowling Alone, he found that starting in, the 1960s, when 50s, when television came out. But basically, television viewing was, you know, the screen time before we had all these different multiplications of screens. And he and a lot of other sociologists have found a direct correlation with a reduction in civic involvement and engagement with the amount of television watching time that people lose. So basically, as soon as TV came out, people stopped sitting on their porches talking to their neighbors, knowing what was going on in the neighborhood. They stopped volunteering, you know, at the PTA, at the Little League. They stopped, you know, and everyone started being inside staring at screens, and that increased and increased the more the screen soma got really good, and it multiplied on the kinds of devices that we're able to use to consume it. But do we want to be the kind of people that watching screens makes us be? If we don't, then what are the things that we can do about it? So we'll get to the thing that we can do about it in just a little bit. But first, let's talk about all the ways that research has established that screen time is actually bad for people. So I'm going to focus on kids here, but all of these effects actually apply to adults as well. They're just stronger among kids because kids' brains are developing. They don't have as much self-control. They don't have jobs and other things that kind of pull them away from the screens. You know, so everything that happens to the kids also happens to adults, just not as much as to the kids because of how little they are and how impulse driven they are. So the first thing that screen time, just screen time, not even addiction, let me find my little pointer here. Oh, here we go. The first thing that screen time does is increases depression, anxiety, and it is also correlated with the increase among in teen suicide. Let me see if I pushed the right button here. Okay. So one of the biggest researchers on the what is called iGEM, which is the generation of kids who are basically in college and younger right now, her name is Jean Twenge. So she wrote a book called iGEM, really in-depth look at them. And so this picture is actually my phone screenshot from the page of her book. That's why it's a little wrinkly looking. what this graph shows is this right here is 1991, and then it goes up to, her data goes up to 2015. And it's showing the percentage of 10th and 12th graders who mostly agree or agree that I often feel left out of things, or a lot of times I feel lonely. So you see in the 90s, it kind of took a dip there, and it plunged in the early 2000s, and then took a huge, sharp uptick. Same thing happens. I mean, and she actually, her whole book is full of graphs like this on all kinds. I just picked a couple of representative things to show you from her book. But she has dozens and dozens of graphs that basically follow the same pattern of, you know, a certain measure of happiness or well-being or doing well in school or something. You know, having ups and downs and blips, but then taking a sharp, you know, increase or decrease depending on negative or positive, right around the time that cell phones became ubiquitous. So right here, this is a picture of the percentage of 12th graders who are satisfied with their lives as a whole and with themselves. So you see the same thing, just jumps right off the cliff, right around the time Instagram and Snapchat show up and Facebook. Well, Facebook is earlier than this, but that didn't saturate to the younger kids until a number of years after it came out. Oh, this is great. This is one of my favorites. I don't know if anybody cares about this except me, but since I love to read, I really care about this. This is a graph of the percentage of 12th graders who read books and magazines, as well as entering college students. So the top line is they read two or more books for pleasure last year. It's down to hovering just above 50%. Let's see, that solid kind of gray line on the bottom right here. That is, did not read for pleasure once in the last year. This is college students. Okay. And then the dotted darker line starting on the bottom, did not read any books for pleasure last year, in the last year, 12th graders, so that's going up. And then the big giant drop is 12th graders who read a book or magazine nearly every day. That's gone like right off the cliff. So Twenge, who is a psychologist, she says the results could not be clear, and she sums up a whole bunch of different studies. If you want the data, you can look in her book, or I'll send you my notes, they have them all in there. But the teens who spend more time on screen activities are more likely to be unhappy, and those who spend more time on non-screen activities are more likely to be happy. There is not a single exception. All screen activities are linked to less happiness, and all non-screen activities are linked to more happiness. That's a pretty strong quote. And it's not just, there's not just a correlation here. Those of you who, if you're a smart high school or college student and you've heard about correlation is not causation, well, I got one for you there. Experiments that randomly assign people to experience either more or less screen time and those that track behavior over time both have found that screen time causes more anxiety, depression, loneliness, and less emotional connection. So it's both, it is definitely correlation. There's studies that show that as well. So the next item, of course, bad things that can happen on the internet. Cell phones seem to increase. I bet the young people in this room will nod their heads, or maybe the grown-ups actually will nod their heads on this one, that not just more access to worse and more access to also worse pornography is available because of the spread of phones. If you know, I just probably have to say the word sexting, and you all are aware, you know, that didn't happen a decade ago. But the other, you know, thing that phone access increases more drama. Have you ever noticed the people, you know, who are glued to their phones, they are just like getting themselves into a tizzy over like the stupidest thing. the stupidest thing. You know, so-and-so didn't look at me in the hallway the other day. Is she mad at me? And then it's something like everybody has to talk about for 3 days. And I personally noticed, I don't have studies for this, but the people who also seem to be most addicted to their phones are also the people who are the most dramatic. I don't know if that's like dramatic people like phones, or phones make people dramatic, or both, but that definitely is a thing that happens, and nobody needs more of that in their life. So the American Psychological Association says that typically the age of first exposure to pornography is 13, and for most kids it was accidental. So, I mean, thank goodness it was accidental, but I mean, I wish that accident never happened. And according to the security technology company Bitdefender, children under the age of 10 now account for 22% of online porn consumption of people who are under 18 years old. There was a viral story in the Texas, I believe, Tribune, just right around the turn of the year, where a mother tells a story of letting her 11-year-old daughter go off to a birthday party at a friend's house. And on the ride home, her daughter says to her, "I hate boys, they're disgusting." And her mom's thinking, "What, you know, you're 11, what could pop?" And so her daughter, you know, clammed up and talked to her, and later that night, her daughter gave her a note. She was too ashamed to tell her in person, but the note told her mother, at this party, their daughter saw some of her friends were Snapchatting, passing around stuff on other people's phones, and one of the things that was sent around was a group of boys laughing at someone being assaulted. And these are sixth grade boys in her class. So my point for bringing that up is not only that that phones make gross things more accessible, but your child doesn't even have to have one. Other people's kids can have them and be sending it to them. I mean, and I know, you know, my kids, they'd be like, "Oh, you know, what is, Joe sent me something. Joe's some random kid at school." They don't know that it's gross till they click on it, and then you can never change the fact that they've clicked on it. So that's another thing that a phone, especially access to young people, provides for them. And I absolutely recommend you having blocking devices in all of your phones. We have had one for grown-ups on our computers, and our oldest is 9, so we're just about to switch over to one that covers the whole family. But my kids don't really use our devices very much for all the reasons that I'm telling you right now. But the other thing that I was mentioning earlier in my introduction is that the combining pornography, you know, there are kids in the room, so I'm going to try to be, you know, as delicate as possible while still conveying the point. But the point is, magazine, you know, Playboy, as all the adults know, is totally not the same as whatever, I don't even know the website, thank God, you know, XXX whatever, you know, online. There is a huge difference between some cute girl in a bikini and watching moving images of grosser and grosser stuff on the computer. And that's only possible because, well, you know, there used to not be moving images available unless you went to these creepy places and you had to ask for it in person. Now you can be anybody if your computer isn't filtered. And the other thing about that is that the online aspect of it makes it a lot, it increases the addictive aspect phenomenally. The other thing about it is that some of you might be aware of this, which it makes total sense when you think of it, but until I had, you know, read more about this, I didn't know, but we are actually having a huge epidemic of people unable to, let's say, procreate. And the reason is among young people under 40, and the reason for that is pornography. They aren't able to enjoy in-person interactions because pornography has completely deadened them. And so there's actually these online communities of young men who are swearing off pornography because they're like, "Hey, I love my girlfriend. I want to like to touch her instead of thinking she's gross." There's something twisted and wrong about that. Yeah, there is, buckaroo. And the reason, you know, and so luckily that, you know, but it wouldn't have been better if someone had said to them, "Hey, you don't want to get started with this stuff, it's as bad as cocaine," right? If we had a cultural norm around that, people telling them before they get into it, and then have to realize by the fact that, wow, like, I can't love somebody, you know, then they have to, anyway. But I'm a huge fan of preventative treatment of all kinds of terrible problems. And of course, as you probably, you know, are all aware, pornography makes people less happy in their marriages and more likely to divorce. It makes men, no surprise, less empathetic to women. More likely to treat them like objects and less like people. And there's a correlation also, I mean, there's something that I'm going to call, oh my goodness, 10 years ago, I would have never been able to talk about any of this in public. Now I'm an old married woman, it doesn't matter. Okay, so but the pornification of our culture, I don't know if you all, you know, maybe heard that phrase, but it's absolutely happening. Have you all heard about the fact that Sesame Street is about to feature a gay drag queen performer? Oh, you're all aware of it. I mean, right? That is an adult show, you know, whether it should happen or not. Like, that's an adult behavior, and then we're showing literal preschoolers it on public sponsored television. So these sorts of things start, you know, in creepy, off in, you know, weird places, and then, but they're getting more and more endemic. And again, even if someone isn't looking for them, you know, like the data I just said, you know, says, even if you're not looking for it, because it's out there, it's going to find you. So, anyway. And part of the reason it's able to find you is because everybody's on their phones all the time and stuck staring at them. Okay, we'll get off this gross project and a topic, but I think necessary to discuss, and talk about the effects on learning. So one of the reasons that I actually got into learning about and thinking about and saving information about screens on kids was the effect on learning. Because I don't know, I mean, probably all of you are aware at this point, but about 5 years ago, 3 to 5 years ago, online learning was the biggest, coolest thing, and the smartest school districts were going one-to-one. You know, now that's way, way more common. Many more school districts are doing that, and we were told, you know, it's going to make kids so much smarter. They were preparing them for the 21st century economy. It'll save time when the coronavirus kills us all. We'll be able to learn a little bit more on the way. Everything is great about this. And I was skeptical. And it turns out that my skepticism was warranted, because as the data's come out about kids, not just because screen time is directly correlated with a lack of reading, but it also is just hugely correlated with less brain growth and basically greater stupidity, which you probably are not surprised of if you look out at the world and you're like, yeah, everybody's pretty stupid. Well, now you know one of the reasons why. So one of my favorite pictures of this is, yeah, I have my own brain scan, and these are scans of preschool age children, and they're showing the organization of the white matter in the brain. So the white matter in the brain is the smart stuff, and this one is the stuff that basically relates to your language and literacy. I shouldn't have to tell you, but language and literacy is massively, hugely important for everything from reading to just being able to communicate to your family and friends. So basically what this shows on, let's see here, on the right-hand side, let me check my notes to make sure that I'm saying this correctly. The toddlers, or the preschoolers on the right-hand side, are children who have been read to by their caregivers. The children on the left-hand side are children who have watched a lot of television. And so what you see on the right, it looks like there's smaller, you know, red activity going on, but what that actually is greater organization of the brain. So they're little, I always wonder how much background knowledge to assume. So their neurons, their neural pathways, the connections between the different parts of their brain have gotten organized, and they're preparing for the child to be able to be doing really well in school. On the left-hand side, you see this is a disorganized brain. There are not connections between the different sides. It's not creating information, so it's scattered, it's distracted. Which, by the way, what's the feeling you get when, you know, when you've been staring, you know, scrolling through Facebook for a while, scattered, distracted? I call it like brain fat. I feel like my brain is fat. Like, I've been sitting on the couch eating a bunch of potato chips. I mean, you can see their brains look like their brains have been eating a bunch of brain potato chips. And it's not the kids' fault. They're 3 years old. You know, they only get what their parents are giving to them. I mean, there's the research on this is completely unequivocal. So population-based studies, translation studies on lots of people, show associations between excessive television viewing in early childhood and cognitive language and social-emotional delays. And the earlier kids use, you know, and the more that kids use screens, the worse their brains get, and the harder it is for them to learn once they get to school. And the converse has also been found to be true in the research. So what actually is extremely good for very little children is one-on-one in-person interactions. And they actually, researchers just found this study, I love it, that when a parent or any grown adult or, you know, friend, middle school or whatever, any bigger person is playing with a toddler, their brains literally sync, S-Y-N-C. So the little child's brain It's following along with the bigger person's brain, and that way it's growing. It's kind of adopting the behaviors and a way of thinking of an adult and mature person, and literally the person playing and interacting with the child going back and forth is helping the child mature and grow. So if the child never gets that they're what my husband and I have a term for this, it's called a feral child. F-E-R-A-L, like a wild animal. It's not the child's fault. Nobody has been talking to the child, you know, responding to them, interacting with them, reading them books. All of that face time, that being there for them time, is really what makes their little brains grow and develop. And just being basically put in front of a screen, it doesn't do anything to develop that. It cannot possibly replace those in-person interactions. So contrary to the claims that we hear all the time, the screen time is just really not good for kids. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is one of my favorite ones about brain differences. And so this is one for grown-up people. Let's see here. Here we go. I don't know if any of you have, heard about, wrong button. I just actually did an example of what I'm going to talk about. So, researchers have found that it's actually a lot more stressful to read and to consume information online because your brain has to make decisions about what it's going to do in a way that you don't. So I'm looking at this paper here. I can't like touch it, click on it. You know, nothing that I do to it is going to change the information that I see. So therefore, it is a lot simpler and easier to comprehend, and I can follow a longer train of argument. But if you're doing that on a screen, and research has found this among middle, high school, and college students, that their reading comprehension is noticeably lower, even if they're reading the exact same thing on a Kindle, Kindles are pretty, you know, dull, pared down, they're not like an iPad. But, you know, even if you're reading it on a Kindle, because your brain, it's called cognitive switching, you have to make a decision at the link, or you're used to, clicking over here to this new tab, clicking there to that video to see that thing. And what that does is it increases the number of things that your poor little brain has to keep track of at one time. And brains can only keep track of really a limited, no matter how, if you're a neurosurgeon, brilliant person, you know, your working memory can only handle, you know, a few things at a time. So basically reading online is a lot more exhausting, and also you learn a lot less, regardless of whether you're a child or whether you're a grown-up. And the other thing about this is that brains are what they call plastic. So every time that you read in a distracting online manner, you're training your brain to be used to reading in a distracting online manner. So you probably have noticed this if you go to a book and like you feel like you should be touching something or turning a page or like twitching here, twitching there, and it makes it harder to focus. That's because that's your brain on screen time. Your brain is used to reading in that way. And so you literally shape your brain to be distracted and unable to comprehend. I think this has obvious implications for public discussion, people's ability to pick good leaders and vote well, people's ability to have a good marriage. You know, I have absolutely found, when my work, I now do specific things in my work to try to reduce the amount of switching and jumping from here to here, but I had noticed in conversations with my husband, you know, he would sit there and I'd be like, why is he droning on and on and on? And I was like, he's only been talking for like 20 seconds. If you can't follow your husband, you know, or anybody that you love for 20 seconds, there's a problem here. So I'm sure all of you have seen those sorts of effects in your own lives as well. So it's not just like it's something that you can leave behind with a computer. It's something that's shaping who you are and shaping how you interact with the world and coming with you wherever you go. And that's the same thing. If you've all heard about maybe the Twitter effect, makes you more irate, more emotional, more likely to jump to conclusions. These are all habits of mind and behavior that are created by people who spend too much time on screens. And that, at this point, that's all of us, me included. Okay, so I'm just going to pop through a couple of other highlights. I'm going to talk about the bigger implications of why this matters. As you can guess, screen time has been extremely bad for physical fitness. I don't know if you've heard, but something less than 20% of the American male population could be drafted into the military because they are not physically fit enough. And it's not just the, you know, they're overweight, but it's that literally for their whole entire life, their heart rate is slower. They cannot do, they couldn't get into shape as well as a 1950s recruit could, because their whole life, you know, they have not been developing the kind of, for example, I just learned this the other day. Did you know that boys roughhousing with each other, like hitting and bruising each other, makes their bones stronger? Huh, well, this explains so much. But you know, if, I mean, you would think, okay, well, I would like soldiers who have strong bones, right? You know, it's just tiny things like that, and they all accumulate. And kids absolutely need to get outside and play, and they're just not, because, well, they're spending 20 to 40 hours a week staring at screens instead of digging in the dirt and hitting each other with sticks. So for a second, don't either explain. All I gotta do is look out my kitchen window. Okay, so I mean, for one example, compared to kids 50 years ago, kids today take 90 seconds longer to run a mile, and their aerobic fitness has declined by 5%. That's a major study of 25 million kids in 5 different developed nations, including the United States. And by the way, these problems that I just mentioned, again, it's not like, oh, big deal, you know, we probably won't have another draft in a while, Americans won't stand it. These are major risk factors for heart disease, which is a leading indicator of lifelong health problems. So even if we're not going to be, which I don't want to do, shipping off our sons, you know, to godforsaken countries to not peacekeep for 20 years and spend $3 trillion, oops. Except if we're not going to be doing that with our sons, you know, I do want my sons to have healthy hearts and have, you know, be able to live a long, healthy, productive life, and not playing outside is a reason that they would do that. Okay, and that also ties into motor development. Kids just, they need to play outside, they need to get their hands wet, they do need to hit each other with sticks, they need to roll in the dirt, and they will naturally do that if you don't let them have any screens. Ask me how I know. I don't only have 5 of my own doing it. We have all the neighborhood kids like in and out of our yard all the time doing it in our yard, and in my mudroom, which is very aptly named. but the thing is, remember those organized brain pictures, actually physical activity for not just, especially for kids, but the things that they do with their hands, both fine motor skills, fine as, you know, tiny things like shaping clay or, you know, sewing, and gross motor skills, so that's like swinging a bat and running, lots and lots and lots of that actually creates the brain infrastructure for their later academic and social development. So it's actually putting into place, if they have millions of, I'm not a very good math person, I just had to stop and think if it's possible to have millions of hours, probably, in childhood, probably. Anyway, rhetorically speaking, millions of hours spent outside touching sand and puppies and poking their fingers, that actually is literally good for their future, their ability to think. And I can connect their ability to think with their ability. For me, I'm most concerned about it because, well, I'm a fellow citizen of these kids. Someday they're going to grow up and vote and decide whether I should be euthanized. I would like their brains to be very, very well oiled at that point. So, I think I've already talked about this. Here's another one of my favorite ones. Actually, screen use is really bad for relationships. A study found studies find, you know, the sky is blue all the time. But sometimes studies find things that we don't want to believe or we wouldn't have expected to believe, and they help kind of bolster, you know, our resolve to do something about it. So that is one of the reasons I like them. Because often my perception of the world is really warped, and so, you know, having some objective information about it can help me reevaluate that. So maybe we can do that for you too. So, but parents' background television use distracts from parent-child interactions and child play. Heavy parent use of mobile devices is associated with fewer verbal and nonverbal interactions between parents and children, and may be associated with more parent-child conflict. So obviously, anyone who's a parent and has a phone has noticed this. If you are distracted by your phone, your kids over time are going to get agitated about that because they need attention. And they need to not be always told, just a second, mommy's talking to, you know, the neighbor or whatever the case is. And the more of that happens, it puts a strain on your relationship. And if that goes on for a really long time, well, there's sometimes you need your parent-child relationship to be really good. You need to have put some money in the bank, so to say, you know, to be able to pull it out when you need your kid, you know, to do A, B, and C that really matters to his life. And one of those things is actually paying attention to him when he asks you 50 times in a row, you know, the same silly question about what's the end of the alphabet song. So, screens get in the way of that. It also finds that, I don't know, I have especially one child who we have a month, so our screen time is on Monday movie night. The kids get to watch some ridiculous movie every Monday. And we have one kid that really exemplifies this, but kids also go through what they call screen withdrawal. There was a time when my son, after every Monday movie night, he would burst out into tears because he wanted to keep watching more movies. But, you know, it's kind of like when as soon as you stopped it, no matter how many he'd seen, he's going to be crying kind of things. And that's actually not just a my son thing. It's screen withdrawal, and it's kind of it's showing that a lot of, if you interrupt their play or their screen time, kids get agitated and will throw tantrums. Everybody probably knows that. But again, that's you're teaching them and you're reinforcing and creating a behavior that's probably best left you know, uncreated and undeveloped into a habit. But another really important thing that Jean Twenge and other people have found about Gen Zers, that's the current generation, young generation, is that screen use makes people worse at social interactions, especially young people, because they haven't had the practice of doing all those awkward things. I remember being, I don't know, 8 or 9 or 10, and mom says, oh, I can't get the phone, can you answer it? And you stand there going, what do I say? You know, you got to do that a couple of times, and then you think, okay, what do I say? Well, what does mom say? Hello. Oh, that wasn't so bad. And the other person says something, and you kind of, you know. So my kids actually had to go through that talking to grandma and grandpa. We do FaceTime with them, you know, every week because they live far away. So in the beginning, they sat there and just stared, and poor grandma and grandpa would be like, trying to coax anything out of them. How was your day? Good. You know, and so, but it's better that that happens when they're 4 than it happens when they're 17. Because and it's not just one interaction, but you've got to work on your social skills for a long time. And then if you have someone getting to college age and they don't know how to ask someone out on a date, well, why do you think nobody's having any babies right now? Well, there's a lot of other reasons, but that, you know, literally, it is one of them. How to make small talk, how to do uncomfortable things, how to call up the doctor when you're sick. I mean, these sound like super simple things, but if people never do them, one of the things that Twenge points out is that the age of adult behavior is increasingly delayed. I mean, we have people in their mid-20s now who are barely doing adult things. My generation of millennials, only 20% of us are married. We're talking people, the millennials are 40 and under. So these aren't like spring chickens here. You know, once you're at 40, you'd be lucky to have a couple of kids, you know, at all, maybe one or two, most likely on average. But the point being, people are doing adult things later and later, and one of the reasons for that is the social interaction, the assuming of responsibility has been delayed, and part of the reason, the other one is, besides the fact that they haven't had a lot of practice, well, mom has swooped in and done that for them, but that's another talk. Okay, and just the last thing that I want to talk, two points. That I want to talk about before we do the kind of last summary bit, is for me, actually, one of the biggest things is opportunity cost. My parents actually were very strict with TV and video games when we were little kids, and when I was a kid, I grumbled about it a lot, and now I'm really, really thankful. So I'm doing what my parents have done with my kids as well, because I think, so my son recently came to me wanting to play Minecraft with his friends. You know, and I thought, you know, big deal, we'll just limit it to like an hour a week, he's 9. And my husband said, our son goes and plays on the piano randomly when he feels like it, when he's bored. He goes outside and plays with the neighbor's dog. He brought up all these things that could get substituted that make my son a beautiful child that we really love, that he's very creative, and he has this whole stable of creative ideas. And not one of them is Minecraft better than. So my husband said, why don't we put this off as long as we possibly can? And I'm thinking back to my own childhood, even college years. There is not 1 hour of StarCraft that I would not willingly have back. So if you look at your kids and think about what you're saving them in terms of, literally playing with the stick in the mud is better for them than playing whatever, washing whatever. So if you're thinking about in terms of opportunity cost, what they're losing, what they're not doing when they're doing the screen, that for me is a huge factor in caring about this issue. And the last thing is to kind of count, I mean, again, everyone, one of the big, I think the strongest reasons to push for, especially screens in schools, is these 21st century skills. But there's a really, really great book by a fellow named Cal Newport. It's called Deep Work, if you want to look it up. But he pulls together a lot of research that talks about the knowledge economy. So the first half of the book basically talks about the distracting and that way that screens change your brain to be frivolous, distracted, and dumb. And then he contrasts that with what the economy right now is rewarding. People who can focus, who can work hard on one specific thing, who can follow a very long train of argument to its logical end. Though people who can do that can make a lot of money and have very successful careers. So actually the opposite of what the internet does to us is what you can get a lot of money for doing. And I don't think that money at all is the be all end all, but if we're going to justify screen time, you know, in economic terms, then we at least ought to be accurate about the economic impacts. But the truth is, the truth is that people don't use screens to be studying quantum physics or anything. You know, I have a number of friends who are teachers, and the screens are just placeholders to keep the kids from causing trouble in class. They're not typically doing almost nothing on a screen that would not be better done with an in-person interaction. So it's saving time and energy for the teacher, and that may be needed in some cases. But I don't really think parents and taxpayers want to be paying for that kind of like low-level, a computer can teach just as well as the teacher who's ostensibly had a lot more experience, you know, and should be better than, you know, little YouTube videos on a thing. So that's kind of an overview of the many different reasons and ways that screen use affects all of us. But for me, one of the things that matters the most is what I kind of talked about at the beginning is what we do is who we are. What we do with our bodies is who we are as a person. I might like to think of myself as a really great mother who loves her kids, and that's true in my heart. But if I'm not acting like a really great mother who loves my kids, or not as much as I could, you know, or if I'm saying, the screen is distracting me from stepping in and parenting when my kids are having a fight, I'm avoiding them and actually not doing my job of parenting, well, that's the thing I need to address as a mother to improve and to become more like the loving mother that I am. It's the same thing, you know, you don't have to be a mother for this. You can, you know, friend, sister, boyfriend, right? If it is distracting you from being a productive citizen and making it, this was something that I didn't mention in the reading section, but those distracting habits of mind literally, you know, make a person who cannot think and follow a long, complex argument. Have any of you ever read the Federalist Papers? Very good. Those are long, complex arguments. And I don't know if any of you, so I'm speaking to a conservative room, we're used to being people who we have complex reasons for, you know, you can't just counter love is love with, no, it's not. That doesn't work. You have to say, well, marriage is really important, and it's because of kids, and men and women aren't the same, and you have to throw in all this information, and, like, spend 10 minutes building your whole case to counter a bumper sticker. And if you're talking to people who can only think in bumper stickers, you kind of are lost before you start. So to the extent to which we have bumper sticker thinking among our citizens is the extent to which the ideas that I think are right and true and enduring are disadvantaged. And that means a lot of pain for us as a society, as I think all of us are amply realizing right now. So this isn't just like a little, oh, screen's bad, you know, Luddite, here she comes to nanny at me about my phone. This is talking about, again, what kind of a people are we as individuals, as families in the society? What kind of habits of mind develop a self-governing country, people who can manage their own affairs and who are able to hold big ideas in their brains and apply them to their everyday life? I want more of those people in my society. In order for us to get more people of those in our society, we have to be those people first ourselves. We can't be hypocrites. And we also have to then encourage, encourage whatever policies or in conversations, talk about it with our friends, encourage more of the kind of self-governing behavior, even in things that seem as small as staring at your phone a number of times a day. Do we have a handout for this? I do have a handout.
We do.
And where is it available for people?
It's going to be available, but remember you have another subject.
Yes, I was going to do the break next, but I wanted to just talk about the handout real quick.
But before you do that,
okay.
I have to tell on you.
Uh-oh.
She had a millennial moment, and I have to tell you about this. We were having a discussion about how many books you should bring. She wrote a book, it's over here, right there, I think you'll recognize it. Pick it up, please.
Okay.
And she said, well, people don't read books anymore. I said, Joy, they won't read a book they don't have. Talk to us about your book before you stop.
Okay. Well, the reason I'm hesitating is because I'm going to talk a bit about this. I'm going to go more into this tomorrow morning because that's my one of my Common Core talk. But
as a good salesman, you have to tell them about this. They won't be here.
I'm not really used to selling stuff. Sorry, guys. I'm going to reorganize this a little bit. So I want to finish. I don't want to jump from one thing to the other. So I'll set yours aside after the thing that I was going to do. So there's a handout that is basically has, I like to be very practical and I have to break things down into very small steps, otherwise I'm not going to do them. So I have a handout that Dick can tell you later where it's going to be available. They're in the back, okay. That basically talks about how to change a habit and how to pay attention to your habit and some ideas. And one of my big things actually about screen time is if you treat it like an addiction, addiction is kind of a big word. Maybe not at the level at which I'm talking about here. If we're talking about societal collapse because we can't think, okay, maybe addiction fits. I don't think you can just go cold turkey. I think it's best to replace it with something else. So not just say, no, 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 don't, never eat the chocolate, say, or don't smoke the cigarette or whatever the case may be. A healthier and more productive way to handle it is to start small, and then, increasing it better, but really is to replace a bad habit with a good one. So, you can't just go whole hog, and whatever habit you're trying to change, you want to start with, okay, I'm going to try to not look at my phone at dinner time with my family, one thing. Or I try not to look at my phone on Saturdays, because I work Sunday through Friday, so Saturday is my screen-free day. Your thing might be, okay, I'm going to start with this little thing, and instead, my handout goes through this, what am I going to do instead? I'm going to do something I like. I'm going to play with the dog, I'm going to paint, I'm going to read a picture book to my kids, we're going to play one of those family board games in the closet that we never seem to get out. Whatever the case may be, replace it with something you like. Heck, go ahead and make yourself some chocolate cupcakes, I don't care, it's better than having, a distracted brain and family. So my handout really goes into that in real detail. It's only a one-pager, and it makes it simple and easy, I think. And I actually love feedback on that because I have a lot of material on this topic that I am planning to turn into an ebook as well as a course for replacing your habits online that I'm going to put out this summer. So you guys are my guinea pigs. Let's see here. But I think there's just two things that I would highlight, and I'm not sure. I don't think they're on the handout, is first of all, parent media use predicts child media use. If you want your kids to do something different, you're a family leader, you need to do something different. And the second thing that you need to know is there is a coalition of parents called Wait Till 8, and as well as Jean Twenge, I don't know if she's a part of it, but she recommends don't give your kid a cell phone as long as you possibly can. And when you do, give them a dumb phone. Right? But usually parents give their kids a phone because they'll say, oh, I'm worried about them. I'm afraid they're going to, they're going to soccer. There's legitimate reasons. But, if they get stuck in a ditch, they can call you with a dumb phone. They don't need to have poor and accessible, stuff on their phone in order to tell you, hey, mom, soccer practice is going to be 30 minutes late or whatever. So those are the two big recommendations. that I don't. And the last thing is, some good news about neuroplasticity. That's if your brain can change to be distracted, even no matter how old you are. This is so encouraging to me because I feel very old. Half of you are laughing and thinking I'm ridiculous, but I feel old. And it's half pregnancy. It makes me feel very old. But neuroplasticity also works in the other way. You can train your brain to do bad things, and you can also train your brain to do good things, which is great. I mean, because I have other kinds of habits that I also can't seem to get rid of, and that's very encouraging to me to hear that, yes, you can change. Might have to put a lot of work in it. But I just wanted to close with a quote from Jean Twenge, and I'll talk about my book. She says, our brains have to be retrained to multitask, and our brains, if we do it all the time, brains are remarkably plastic, remarkably adaptable. We train our brains to new ways of thinking. And then when we try to revert our brains back, our brains are plastic, but they're not elastic. They don't just snap back into shape. It changes based on experience. So you can retrain your brain, but it's going to take a lot of hard work. But really, you can do it. And I have some ideas on the handout. Now, the book, that's my first book. And I always have, it's my first book since being grown up. When I was a teenager, I had my journal published by a small art house. But I felt really, so Deborah is more aware of this perhaps than anyone else in the room. But Common Core, for me, started out as a reporting thing. I was an education reporter. And I was hearing about this. Moms were calling me saying, like, what is this Common Core thing? And I, Googled it, can't really find much information. Before it became a big thing, I tried to find out what it was and really couldn't find any good information. And then once I did start finding information, it was kind of surprising and scary, so I started looking into it more. And I published, what I found, and because I was publishing some of the few things that were available online at the time, a lot of people, found my articles who were beginning to look for Common Core. And so as it grew and kind of crested in about 2015, I was reporting and talking to the parents and following the movement around the country, and it really changed my perspective. I hate to say this, but it changed my perspective on our government a lot, because I had been taught to believe, the kind of textbook civics view of our government. Representative government, you have your House and your Senate and your presidency and you vote for the person, and it doesn't really work that way anymore. Our government is very little of it is controlled by elections, and it's getting even less controlled by elections, and it's getting harder and harder for people like us to influence. And actually, I'm going to talk about that in the next talk with the LGBT talk. So for me, the Common Core story, and I'm going to talk about this tomorrow, is really a story of government corruption applied to education, but there are a lot of stories about it. I mean, the general pattern, once I learned about it really in depth with Common Core, I began to see that it was everywhere. Our whole government works this way. So if you want to look at what a mess our government is and why we've spent 70 to 80 years trying to fix American schools and they're only getting worse, my book tells about that.
And it's worth reading. And thank you. What do you think of this lady? Thank you.